This is Wildlife by the Numbers, a podcast about wildlife ecology, focused on the proper and robust design of studies concerned with the conservation and management of fish and wildlife. We hope to entertain and enlighten young and aspiring wildlife ecologists, along with seasoned professionals. Our wish is to help guide the application of science and conservation. My name is David Stewart.
Ray Harris.
I'm Matt Butler.
And today we're going to talk some more about sampling and random sampling, and when random sampling, which is something we always want to strive toward, may take different flavors, and how we go about doing that. In prior episodes, we've spoken about tomatoes and tomato plants and how we want to do random sampling of tomato plants. And frankly, I might be sick of tomatoes right now. So we are going to switch the example to forest birds, something that Randy and his colleagues have been working on recently as far as trying to estimate abundance of forest birds in these bottomland hardwoods, mainly neotropical migratory birds, which are declining across North America for a number of different reasons. Some of it's habitat loss in the breeding grounds, which is here in North America, and some of it's also habitat loss in Central America where they winter.
So, Grant, when you sent the transcript, you had a statement on here, when random sampling's not your friend. And that really poked at my philosophy of science. Can you help us understand what you're getting at? And when is random sampling not your friend? Like, what context are you talking about?
Well, what I was thinking of was, in the context of tomato plants, we had used a garden and said, okay, in this garden, how many tomatoes do we have? And we wanted to use random sampling because we knew we had some places with high abundance and some places with low abundance and some places with no tomatoes at all within our garden plot. So our garden plot is our sampling frame. Now, let's say I have a very big yard and the garden only contains a small fraction of that yard. And I want to count how many tomatoes I have, and I do some random sampling across my entire yard. That seems a bit foolish because I only have tomatoes in my garden. And so I'm wasting a lot of effort and a lot of time sampling places where I know definitively there aren't going to be any tomatoes. The take home on that, we have to be very careful on what our sampling frame is and define that sampling frame so we can kind of hone in on where we should put our random sampling, as I understand it.
Basically, the context here is, the context is important. In other words, where in the world are your tomatoes matters when it comes to designing your sample frame. Now, Randy earlier brought up a really good point when we were talking before the podcast about, if your species is super, super rare, and you don't really know where it occurs in the first place, that their approaches to dealing with sampling in those scenarios. And dive off into that a little bit for us, Randy, and just help us begin to think through what those processes might look like.
Yeah, oftentimes we're developing studies. We either know very limited information about the study area and the species and how they use it. And so in many cases, as part of traditional random sampling, you have to know something about that study area and how the species uses. You can allocate your areas of your data collection points in a manner that that represents the true distribution of the species, so that any abundance or occupancy estimates are truly reflective of that area. And in doing so, if the species is evenly distributed, traditional random sampling will work quite well. But if they're clumped or they have a very restricted range, there is a chance in which traditional random sampling is not going to be the most cost-efficient sampling method to collect that data.
So, Randy, could you maybe, for our listeners, give more specifics on the bottomland hardwood forest? My understanding is, 100 points are placed within a forested refuge, and the goal is to estimate abundance of a suite of neotropical migrants. And for, which species is that working well? And for which species is that not working well, and why?
Well, in the instance of our examples, one refuge only has 18 bird point counts, so not even 100, and 100 sounds much better. However, just that survey alone, what we found is that the species is very common, they're widely distributed. We do a fairly good job, even with 18 bird point counts, of estimating abundance. And then when you go through the process of understanding whether or not that is enough effort to accurately estimate abundance, I would sort of precisely estimate that abundance, it generally does a pretty good job. But for those rare species that are either rarely encountered or just rare to begin with because of the lack of habitat, you know, we do a very poor job of estimating our density. And then what happens afterward, we go through to determine what it takes to get a precise estimate of abundance. You know, it requires hundreds and hundreds of bird point counts. And that's a reflection of, one, them not being there, and also maybe their habitat limited in that same place, which is what's driving their rarity.
So like a species like the Swainson's warbler that we know is it favors these cane breaks. And these cane breaks are like cane habitat that are in, you know, forest gaps within a that kind of bottom end forest habitat. And they like those habitats. But they're also kind of sparsely distributed within those habitats. So if you put out 18, 20, 50 point counts that are random within the bottomland hardwoods, you might miss that habitat entirely. Or you might just get like two or three of them. And now you're saying, okay, now how do I estimate abundance of a Swainson's warbler when I really have three places where it could possibly occur?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, once you think of like 18 versus 50 to 100, the chances of encountering them increases significantly with the number of bird point counts you put on the landscape. But if you did happen to know something about the distribution of the habitats that they're using, then you can entertain using different randomized designs, like stratified random design or a clustered design, or even two-stage sampling versus just traditional random sampling. That way you increase your efficiency in terms of the amount of effort that you're placing, and then it helps you improve your detections, which is gaining information about them.
When I was doing wolverine work in Alaska in a previous life, we were setting out these traps for wolverines, and we had a number of different folks that were fur trappers helping us out and setting traps and where we should put them. And the key advice one of the older trappers gave me is, if you want to catch an animal, you got to go where it is. And that was just like, right, that's pretty foundational stuff right there. And so this is a common issue in wildlife biology, is where we want to sample something, but in order to sample it, we got to know where it is. But we also want to make sure that when we sample, we're doing it in a random way, so we're not biasing a result, as we've spoken about in prior podcasts. And so, Randy, you spoke about, you know, stratified sampling, and then you can go to two-stage sampling, which is adaptive sampling, that's another term for it, or some sort of a focused sampling. You know, Matt or Randy, you guys want to speak to that at all, like what that progression looks like and how that would work?
You know, with stratified sampling, I feel like we use that a lot. And it's just a way to allocate our samples in a way to try to control the overall variance in your estimate, right? So we have a high density area, maybe a low density area. We might not put as much effort in maybe we put it more in the low density area. It just kind of depends on your scenario, but and what your objectives are. But you're going to put some of your sample randomly into one of your strata, so your low density area or your particular kind of lower quality habitat type, and then part of your sample in the other one. And that's just a way to kind of control that overall variance. Whereas if you just did a random sample across the whole thing, your final variance estimate is pretty large typically.
So before we leave stratified sampling, I know some of the work we're doing at another refuge at San Andres is putting out some camera traps to get imagery of oryx, which is a naturalized species that came from Africa that was released back in the 40s or so, but it's here in New Mexico. So we want to get numbers of oryx. We're getting pictures of mule deer and desert bighorn sheep. And we stratified that mountain range with like a low elevation zone and a high elevation zone. And for this analysis, he's given the relative densities of the species in the question. We put a fewer amount of cameras in the low density area, in the low elevation area, and a higher density of cameras in the high elevation area. We stratified it based on where we knew sheep would be, if we were looking at impacts of oryx on sheep habitat. So is there ever, but if you don't know what your strata should be, how you should stratify it, does stratification ever hurt you?
Generally, no. I've learned to not be so emphatic when it comes to stuff like that. Like, theoretically, it shouldn't. You know, if you go read the base sampling books, oh yeah, do this. It can't hurt you. I feel like I've seen situations where maybe it did a little bit, but I think those are rarities. So generally it should help, but by help, all we're talking about is help you reduce your overall precision. I was using the word variance a while ago. Wrong word. Your overall precision in your estimate. And we do that at Bitter Lake National Wildlife Refuge with our snails and amphipods. We have two endangered spring snails and an endangered amphipod in that stream that we're sampling for. And we've stratified that stream based on kind of the lower reach is pretty low abundance, the middle reach is kind of the stronghold, and then the upper reach, again, is kind of a lower abundance. And by stratification, we're better able to control the precision in our final estimate. And so that's the real reason we're doing that there. It's not really the target or sample in any way, because the snail, but the snails and the amphipod are found throughout, just in different abundances, from the low end to the middle, and then at the upper end. So it's really just to drive that to better control your precision and your final estimate. So I feel like the San Andreas example wasn't necessarily completely about like how much precision we're going to get in our final estimate. It was more about trying to better allocate our sample in a way that we understand oryx overall on the mountain, but then have more targeted sampling in the places where we expect that oryx and sheep could be interacting. And so we wanted to have a little more increased sampling effort in those areas so we could better capture what's going on with that, with those two populations where they interact. So you do these kinds of things for different reasons. And it just kind of depends on your question. Like if my sole question is to estimate the total number of snails in Bitter Creek with as much precision as possible, the stratification is great.
And that's what you do to get that. You get an estimate for low, medium, and high reach, and then you combine them at the end, or do you do them at the same time?
Yeah, well, it's, yeah. Yeah, it's both.
Yeah. But you have separate, you compartmentalize your estimates. So you get a variability for the low and the mid and high reach, and then you can pull that within the same model to get your final estimate.
Yes. I'm over here shaking my head as if y'all can see me.
All right, so two-stage adaptive sampling. What does that look like, Randy?
You go out and collect an initial sample. Let's say you use traditional random sampling during that time. Once you collect that, either one, you identify areas of interest. Others, in order to show it or express it, they develop predictive models using the initial sampling design. Then once they have those predictive maps, then they can use that to then do it more. They still use random sampling, either a stratified random sample at the second time, or just simply another random sampling where they are focusing on allocating those sites to areas of interest to help improve the information they gained. It's pretty popular for rare and endangered species, where you go out and do an initial survey and bring information back and then kind of develop a random procedure behind the initial survey to have a more targeted approach the second time.
So what would that look like in our bottom line hardwood example with the warbler, with the Swainson's?
Well, in this case, ideally you're collecting habitat variables at the same time, but going out and having that mapping exercise for habitat, associating that with your point count data that is collected randomly the initial time, developing your predictive maps based on those habitat associations. If not just a habitat association, using expert opinion from previous studies or previous information from previous studies to kind of guide what that initial sample would look like, for instance. There are multiple ways you could approach it. And then that second sampling design, develop that stratified random, allocation procedure where you're favoring habitats with a weighting scheme.
So the first survey you would say, okay, we're serving for birds and for different habitat types. And from that survey, ideally you would say, okay, hey, this is my map or my distribution of canebrake habitats. And so that's the first step in that two-stage sampling. Then the second step, say, okay, we are now going to focus solely on canebrake habitats if our interest is purely on the Swainson's warbler, given its tight association with that habitat. And so then we allocate sampling effort only in the canebrakes. Is that what you mean?
No, not necessarily. I mean, you're collecting information about the species too, because the species habitat, you know, generally for most species still varies very slightly, even if they have a close association with canebrake. So it's found mostly in early successional stages too. So it doesn't necessarily have to have a canebrake. So you want to collect information about the species, the habitat of interest. Yeah, and in this example that I'm using, and it's not always the case, you can develop predictive maps, and then your second wave of surveys, now you have a general understanding based on the study area of interest. Because you did collect it from a random sample initially, you can now generalize those results to the broader population, which is the study area of interest. Now, go across, you know, implement additional random sampling in areas of interest using, let's say, stratified random sampling procedures where you're favoring certain habitats, but not always specifically focusing, in this case, only on canebrakes, because there is a chance that species has enough variation and habitat selection in that area of interest that they're not going to be found just there. So you want to make sure you give those habitats equal representation or some degree of representation to remove selection bias.
So, like in this example, then it would be like, say we have a large expanse of bottomland hardwood forest. We want to put out 100 survey points. Our first step is really just to understand the distribution of these early successional canebrake habitats with some of the species. We go through and do that, even without the 100 points, we go through and figure that out. And then once we have that predictive map, then we can allocate our 100 points and say we're going to favor our point allocation in early successional cane habitats, fewer points in the other, in alternative habitats. So we do a two-stage with also a stratification step.
Yeah, exactly. Because you still want the whole procedure to represent a random sample, which requires randomization, making sure there's no selection bias. Other habitats have some degree of representation in your survey design. And then that way, the statistical models that you can use are valid.
Now, we know that surveying birds can be an expensive endeavor. You know, it takes people to go out there and do this stuff. It's hard to put out hundreds of points in all these different spots. So given cost limitations and stuff, the temptation now is say, hey, we know where canebrake habitat is. Let's just go to those places and count birds. Is there any risk on that, Matt?
I don't know. If I was sampling snails, I'm not going to go sample them in the upland where they're not at. So I don't know enough about Swainson's warblers. I think they occur in a few other places.
They do. I'm making the assumption they're only in canebrakes, but they bleed out to other spots.
It depends on what your objectives are. If your objective is to only estimate the species that occurs in canebrakes, Swainson's warbler, which may or may not be completely canebrake, then it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to go sample places that it's not. If you know it can occur there, like this, the really easy example is the snail, like a spring snail. Well, it doesn't make sense to sample places that aren't springs. So go sample springs. That's why they're called spring snails. Like why one would want to sample more, and it's usually because like in bird surveys, you're trying to do more than one thing, right? You're trying to say something about Swainson's warblers, but you're also trying to say something about the rest of the bird community at large that occurs on your refuge or whatever you're focused in on. So there's your reason that you go outside the canebrakes. Maybe I'm missing something here.
I don't think so. The key to this is that even if you're just tied to canebrakes or tied to springs, which are snails, right? So if you're tied to canebrakes with Swainson's warbler, right? Say they're a tight association. You're focusing on spring snails that are in springs. You still want to pick a random sample of springs that you will sample and a random sample of canebrakes that you sample. You don't just want to say, I'm just going to sample these ones and call it good.
I'll sample these because they're close to the trough.
Right.
I guess the other key to all that is, so if my sample frame is canebrakes on Washita National Forest and in Arkansas and Oklahoma, and I want to go sample only canebrakes that I've identified via remote sensing, I'm only going to sample those places for Swainson's warbler. We're going to go sample those places, and I get an estimate. Okay, cool. Well, that estimate is only applicable to your central fund. It's not applicable to the National Forest. So when I said we have X number of swings and warbler on Washington National Forest, well, I'm wrong. We have X number of swings and warblers in canebrakes on Washington National Forest. There may be swings and warblers in other places that we didn't sample or were not part of our sample frame. That's the minority part of the population that doesn't use canebrakes. So we got to be explicit in how we describe our estimate and make sure what we're saying matches our sample frame so people understand what it was we were actually estimating.
So would you say that's an example of focused sampling? Is that what we're talking about here?
Okay, so.
And let's say you're on a small refuge that has a lot of bottomland hardwood forest on the refuge, but the refuge itself is, you know, somewhat small in the big scheme of things. And from what we know from some mapping, there's like maybe four or five spots that are canebrake habitats. I would say some of the discussion we've had before would be just survey those four or five spots. Because it knows your random sample, what's it mean? You only have four or five spots to begin with. So that's not your survey frame of where you're going. And that'd be like focus sampling on that refuge.
Yeah, that would make sense. And basically you got a census at that point.
Right. And if you could pool across different refuges if that was appropriate, then you might be able to build a random sample across refuges and representative habitats like that.
Right. And actually start to get some power and be able to estimate detection probabilities and all those other things we like to worry about.
I don't know. Anything more on this?
I don't know. I think you beat it to death.
I don't think so.
Okay. Hey, everybody. Hope you learned something about sampling and different types, right? We began with random sampling, and then we talked about stratified sampling. We talked about two-stage sampling, which is adaptive sampling. And then we moved into focus sampling, talking about snails, talking about warblers. We even talked a little bit about tomatoes, even though I tried to avoid it, but it was important for context.
Don't forget about sheep and oryx.
That's right. Sheep and oryx, too.
Thank you for listening to Wildlife by the Numbers. We hope you enjoyed it and maybe learned something. We hope to see you next time.